Today's episode is brought to you by Angie. Angie has made it easier than ever to connect with skilled professionals to get all your jobs and projects done well. Let me tell you, there's the version of it where you try to do something at home, and then there's a version of it where you have someone help you, you watch them do it the right way, and you go, thank God I didn't try to do that myself. I have fully done things around the home that I think look good, and then a bang in the night, and I wake up to a shelf collapsing, a painting falling off the wall. Like, it, I've seen it all go south. I own a home, and I can tell you, I know how much work it can take. Whether it's everyday maintenance and repairs or making dream projects a reality, it can be hard just to know where to start. But now all you need to do is Angie that and find a skilled local pro who will deliver the quality and expertise you need. Whatever your home project, big or small, indoor or outdoor, you can Angie that and connect with skilled professionals to get the project done well. Right now, one of my wish lists is I want a bike for my condo in Milwaukee, and I would love to rig it up on a pulley in the ceiling because I have one of those like lofted ceilings, but I'm so scared to try that on my own. Angie has 20 years of home experience and they've combined it with new tools to simplify the whole process. Bring them your project online or with the Angie app. Answer a few questions and Angie can handle the rest from start to finish or help you compare quotes from multiple pros and connect instantly, which means you can take care of any home project in just a few taps. Because when it comes to getting the most out of your home, you can do this when you Angie that. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Worst First. I am really excited. I have a very special guest here today who I was introduced to through Mickey Avalon, who I love, who's a dear friend of both of us. And it's Ryan Leone, and he has a book called Wasting Talent, which is about your life when you were in prison, before prison, how you got to prison, in prison, and then now your life clean and sober and happy and doing your best life right now.
Yeah, the book's a novel. So
it's a novel.
It's like a fictional account of it.
Okay.
It's basically covers the years before I went to prison the first time. I've been to prison three times, but the first time I went, that covers like the junkie years before that.
My years
as a heroin addict.
Which is, so you're like literally a year, you're 35?
35.
So you're literally a year older than me. And I'm like, you've been to prison three times in your life. And how long were each of those stints?
The first one, I got sentenced to 5 years. I did 4.5.
Okay.
The second time was for a probation violation. I did 90 days, but actually in prison, not jail. And then the last time was 16 months, and I had been sentenced to 3 years, 8 months. But you do like half time in state, so it, you know, it doesn't translate literally to 3 years, 8 months.
Okay, so I'm just going to ask you 1,000 questions because, like, I've never had anyone on my podcast who's been to prison. I mean, my husband's been to prison, but he was in isolation, so it's not, like, the same thing. But I want to know everything about you. I'm really curious to know, like, where did you grow up?
I grew up in Santa Barbara, California.
You grew up in Santa Barbara?
Picturesque town.
And what about the family?
Family, good, upper-middle-class family. No trauma. No abuse for me. My parents have been married 40 years. Great people. You're probably like, why were you a heroin addict, right?
Like, I'm trying to figure it out.
You know, I think in retrospect, I had really debilitating ADD.
Okay.
And it made me insecure because it took me a lot longer to learn how to read than my peers. I got held back a grade in sixth grade. And then by the time I got to high school, that's when, you know, everybody starts trying drugs. And all of a sudden, I didn't feel insecure anymore. I mean, that's the common tale with drug addiction.
What was your first drug?
Probably over-the-counter medications like Coricidin, cough and cold.
Wow.
Robitussin and stuff
you
like
robo-tripped.
That.
You robo-tripped.
Yes.
And you loved it.
I don't know if I loved it, but I loved it more than the reality that I was living. You know, I loved getting out of my own head. And then I got into, you know, I started smoking weed, started drinking, and I got expelled from three schools within the span of a month when I was in high school. And my parents didn't know what to do. They were freaked out. So they sent me to programs for troubled adolescents. I went to a wilderness program. I saw a kid slit his wrist the first day that I was there. I was really traumatized.
Wait a minute. We got to stop. Okay. So you were at a wilderness program.
Yep.
For kids that were troubled. Mm-hmm. And How did you see this kid slit his wrists?
So the first day that we were there, I mean, the whole, I guess the whole concept behind it was we'd been enabled by our families. They wanted to break us down materially and then build us back up. So they teach us survival skills, like how to make fire with two sticks, stuff like that. We'd have to hike like 10 miles a day with 80-pound backpacks on. First day that I was there, we woke up and they had us like eat this big can of peaches when we first got there. That's their, you know, holistic detox remedy. It's really bizarre.
Canned peaches, and
I always heard, and I don't know if this is true, I've never been able to substantiate this, but I always heard that that song Millions of Peaches by the President of the United States of America wrote that song about this place.
Because he'd been there?
I don't know.
Millions of peaches.
Yes, that
peaches
song.
Peaches for me.
Yeah, my young followers are like, what are you talking about? My wife hates that song. Yeah. I always put it on and I'm like, I think they're talking about this place.
Was my childhood. Oh my God, canned peaches. That can't be good for you. All the nutrients are sucked out. It's just corn syrup.
Well, in most of the kids, you know, it's not like we were coming off heroin or alcohol or, you know, or well, yeah, probably a lot of alcohol, but we weren't coming off heroin. I think that the concept was that it would just, you know, it was like a detoxification.
Okay.
I don't know what they were thinking. I'm thinking about it. I'm like, I don't know.
Yeah. Let's give them some canned peaches, which are in tin cans, which just raise their tin levels, and it's full corn syrup. And yeah, like, that'll be great for them.
Yeah. So
mostly sugar. Yeah.
And so this guy didn't like that.
Right.
And he didn't want to be there. So I woke up the first night that I was there. And first of all, you get kidnapped in the middle of the night when
I've heard about these places.
These people come and like grab you. It's really
traumatic.
Really traumatic.
Yeah, I've heard about these places.
You know, when you're 15 and you got these two burly guys standing above you and they're like, all right, you're going to snowboarding camp. But you know that that's not where you're going. Because all of my friends around me were getting sent away. It was like dominoes, like one by one, everybody just started getting sent away. Like our parents got together and like, let's send them away to institutions. So this kid, his name was Andrew. Mm. I met him the night before. Everybody was upset. We just got kidnapped. We got taken there. I woke up the next day and he was on top of a hill and he had taken his peach can lid and like serrated it. And he said, I'd rather be dead than be here. And he just started slitting his wrist the right way. You know.
Yeah, I know.
Vertically.
Don't show the audience.
Oh, yeah. No, no, don't do
we
that.
We don't want anybody to know.
Don't
if
do
you
that.
Don't know, you don't need to know.
And blood just started fountaining out of him. It was like, I've been to prison 3 times, so I've seen a lot of violence in real life at this point. It's not abstracted to me like it was then, but I remember thinking how much it looked like a horror movie and how much I used to think horror movies didn't look like real violence until I actually saw something on that level.
And it was like splurting out.
It was mind blowing. Mm-hmm. It freaked me out.
Did they save him?
They air flighted him out of there. They never told us what happened to him. I don't know if he died. I don't know if, you know, if they were trying to like stitch him back together right in front of us, and they're like, "Don't watch." It's like, how, you know, it's.
They sound great.
Yeah, they were really good people.
Sounds like it went really well at that camp that your parents spent money on.
Oh, it turned out fine. Yeah, it's, you know, so.
My God, so basically you feel like you just had ADD, and I know how I have ADHD. And I don't take anything for it. I was on Adderall for years, but I know how it is. You kind of feel like you're crawling in your own skin and it's like anything to make you chill the fuck out would be great. So I totally feel you on that note. And so drugs, drinking, weed, that kind of thing was the first thing to make you kind of chill.
It wasn't even like initially, it was just the culture. It was like ditching school.
Yeah.
You know, fist fights, sex, drugs, all of that to me, like, I was just really attracted to the whole lot, like the chaos of it.
Mm-hmm.
The drug addiction stuff didn't really emerge until I got out of that place. I was there like 9 months the first time I got sent away. I got sent away a couple times. And when I got back, I was outside like a basketball game. I was 16 and I was with some seniors. So I was a sophomore and these girls were seniors and they took me outside to smoke a cigarette and they were snorting coke out of a bullet. And I didn't know what that, I didn't even know what it was. That's how naive I was. They're like, hey, you want some? And I remember doing a bump and that was a cathartic experience for me. Cocaine was my first love for sure. All of a sudden, like, that's exactly what I was looking for. That inflated ego and the euphoria.
Your parents should have just gotten you an Adderall prescription.
They did do that. In fact, my parents used to put Ritalin. They used to crush it up and put in my applesauce when I was like 6, 7.
It didn't help.
I don't think so.
The coke was more effective.
In fact, I think my neurology got so warped from being on an amphetamine at that age
that now you craved and that rush.
I think I have a neurological propensity towards chemicals because of taking an amphetamine at a young age. There's a documentary coming out about me this year.
Okay.
It's in post-production right now, and that's one of the main hypotheses of the film is that, you know, because what happened to you?
Yeah.
You know, did you get molested? Mm. I didn't. No trauma.
Storybook good childhood, but the parents putting you on Ritalin young, what could be, you know, because it's like our brains aren't developed, you know, obviously until we get much older. And I resonate with you because I got put on an antidepressant at 16 and my brain, I don't think, was fully developed. And I have been stuck on that antidepressant and I'm 34. So
yeah.
I feel you. I get that. And I think that, you know, maybe that did create, as you said, like that propensity for having like amphetamines and having like something in your system.
I think so. I've heard rock stars.
Right.
I know you're married to one. So, but I've heard rock stars. I heard Kurt Cobain. I heard Scott Weiland say it too. I know Kurt Cobain definitely said it, but they were saying the same thing. They thought that the reason they got on heroin later in life was because they were on Ritalin or Adderall as a youngster.
That's so interesting. I mean, I've been on Adderall. I was on Adderall for years for my ADHD, and I actually got to the point where I was like, I can't handle the heart racing. Like that was what I couldn't handle, but you, I think, were telling me that you've kind of, your body, and some people have this, is like people that have tried a lot of drugs or done a lot of drugs, is like you, it takes a lot for something to affect you, right? Like you have a high tolerance.
I tend to have a high tolerance to a lot of stuff. I mean, most drugs I have a high tolerance to, except for like crystal meth. You know, just that stuff makes me so weird and out there.
Uh-huh.
Just a little bit will do that to me for some reason. Wow. Like my brain's not compatible, probably because of the Ritalin and Adderall when I was younger. I don't know.
Right.
But yeah, it's, I don't, you know, my parents are amazing people and they've told me a million times that they're sorry that they put me on medication as a young child like that. Mm-hmm. I'm a father now myself. And I definitely wouldn't do that. You know, I learned from that. Mm-hmm, so it's one of the points of the film is to underscore that, because I do think it's a very important issue that's not talked about enough.
Yeah, it is hard when kids are first developing and you see these things happening, and it's hard because parents just want to help. And, you know, and doctors, you take your kid to the doctor and most Western medicine doctors are going to go, yeah, put your kid on this, put your kid on that, and not thinking about like the long-term effects of what this is going to do. You know, it has its pros and cons, I'm sure, in both ways. But yeah, so then you tried coke and you loved it. And you were 16.
I became a full-blown cocaine addict.
At 16.
I was doing like an 8-ball a day.
How did you get the coke at 16?
I mean, the way you get any drugs, I mean, I just, you know, I had a drug dealer. Then I started dating a girl.
How did you make the money to pay for it?
My parents had savings bonds that they had gotten for me for my college education.
And you fucking cashed your bonds.
I mean, at one point I did 80, like over 80,000 at one time. That was when I was 18. But back in high school, you know, I would find a savings bond for $600, $1,000. Then I started selling it. You know, at a certain point, I started selling it just to sustain the habit. I mean, I was doing $100 worth of coke a day at 16. I started acting the way anybody would act doing that much cocaine, especially at that age. You're not developed, you know. Again, your neurology is very fragile at that point. And I started dating this girl that was 21. She was she went to junior college mm-hmm. in Santa Barbara, and she was selling coke. Her dad was a big coke dealer. And one night I was just really, you know, tweaked out on this coke, pacing, looking out the window. And she had me smoke heroin off tinfoil. She told me it was opium. Again, that was another, you know, life-changing moment for me.
How old were you?
I was 17.
17.
And I started smoking heroin every day. I got physically dependent to it in high school. And
did you keep doing the coke and the heroin?
Yeah.
So yeah. Doing both.
I was doing both.
So you were going up and then down and then up and then down.
Yeah, and that's hard to handle when you're in your early 20s. But at 17, like, I mean...
How did your parents like not know? Because someone who's on coke every day, I mean,
they knew.
They knew
at a certain point they gave up custody. They gave up custody of me, sent me to an orphanage for a little bit. And then I got sent back
at 16.
Yeah. And then I got at 17. And then I got sent back to another program in Utah for troubled adolescents. I graduated high school and I'd gotten some writing published when I was 9, also in high school. So
when you were 9, you got writing published?
Yeah.
What did you write when you were 9?
I wrote a short story for Goosebumps fan fiction.
Oh, I loved Goosebumps.
And I won.
So. Good job. You're a creative spirit.
I would say
yeah, you have a creative mind and a creative spirit.
But I didn't want to be a writer back then because it didn't seem as exciting as being a rock star.
Did you want to be?
I think before I was a drug addict, I wanted to probably be a film director. Mm-hmm. And then after I got on drugs, I just wanted to be a drug addict.
Really?
And that was one of the biggest problems I had is that I embraced that culture. And I'd look up to artists, writers, musicians that kind of falsely romanticized drugs. They weren't talking about their friends that have died around them or going to prison or getting communicable diseases or any of the dire consequences that comes with drug addiction. There's nothing glamorous about it. But you don't know that when you're a kid. You just see the facade that they put up because that sells books, that sells records, that sells a personality.
Mm-hmm.
So I embraced that culture. And I thought for a long time I was doing something that was really cool.
I'm an artist. No one understands me. Like I do heroin. I'm poetic. I write and then you see people like, you know, Sid Vicious and like Jimi Hendrix and like all these, you know, Jim Morrison, all these huge rock stars and Janis Joplin, like all these people that were, you know, talking about drugs.
And it seems
doing
great.
Drugs. Yeah. It seems like it's like part of a lifestyle. Like, oh man, they're just like these rebellious, different people. People don't get us, you know, that kind of thing. But you didn't realize like, you know, that there was so much bad to go along with that. It wasn't, you know, what you thought it was.
It wasn't. It wasn't cool. And it took me a long time to get disillusioned by that.
Yeah. So wait, let's continue. You went to you got kicked out of the orphanage. Then you went to Utah.
Again,
and when you went to Utah, second time. Okay. When you went to Utah, did they get you sober? You can't do anything there, right? Like they can't, or were you able to get drugs in there?
No, I wasn't able to get drugs there.
Okay.
And they're not even really equipped to deal with people that are coming off heroin. I was so naive that when I got there, I was sick and I didn't realize that I was dope sick. Mm-hmm. I didn't know that I was in withdrawal.
You thought you just had a flu.
Yeah. And they drug tested me and they're like, you came up dirty for opiates. You know, and back then, I'm not going to tell any authority figure anything. So I was like, no, I don't know what you're talking about. So I kicked heroin cold turkey for the first time at that place. But I think they knew. But it was not equipped to deal with that. It was more for behavioral issues.
So while you're kicking heroin cold turkey, like what does that feel like? Horrible. How long does it last?
It lasts about 7 days, maybe 10 days. The worst part is that you don't sleep. You know, you can't sleep. You're have indecisive skin temperature. Your skin feels like it's crawling. You get diarrhea. You vomit. And then you get this just really intense panic because you know that you can't get anymore, you know? And that's why people go rob liquor stores when they're in withdrawal or, you know, whatever. It's, you just get this intense panic. It's really bad. That's not the worst thing I've kicked. We'll get into that later, but methadone was 1,000 times.
Worse than heroin?
1,000 times more severe.
And isn't that what they give people to get off of heroin?
Yeah.
Ironic.
It's,
big pharma. They want you to be on it forever.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, you can't kick it. You're stuck on it.
Yeah.
Love them.
Yeah, they're good people
they're
too.
They're great. That's so fucked, dude. Okay, so then we got out of Utah. Okay.
I got out of Utah and then my parents, my grades were okay. I got like a 3.2.
Wow.
For my GPA.
That's like me sober.
Well, I only was able to do that because I spent so much time in institutions.
Right.
So my parents got me into a pretty prestigious writing internship program in Worcester, Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm.
It was an internship program, so it was like a year in between high school and college,
mm-hmm.
you know, something to put on your resume or whatever. And everybody that's there, they give you an apartment, They give you an $80 stipend allowance a week. And then you have to go be an intern. And my internship was going to Public Access Channel and learning how to write, you know, spec screenplays and how production works. When I got out there, I met my first true love, this girl, and I just became passionately head over heels in love with her. And we got into drugs pretty quickly. She was bulimic. She had her own set of issues. And I learned, you know, growing up in upper middle class Santa Barbara, I had no experience with ghettos and going into them to score drugs. And so I started kind of going there and looking for what, you know, I think we were doing crack.
Wait, how did you meet the bulimic girl?
She was at that internship
program. She was in the internship program.
Yeah.
And so whose idea was it to score drugs?
Oh, right from the first night that I met her, you know, it was, we were at like a keg party there. It was a bunch of college age kids.
Right.
And we got into, you know, we were doing coke and we were taking ecstasy. We did a lot of mushrooms and acid out there. And then I told her that I used to do heroin in California, black tar out here. Out there, it's China white, so it's powder. Mm-hmm. And she wanted to try it. And so I went and I got burned a bunch of times. You know, I'd probably sound like a cop. Hey, you know where I can get any heroin? You know, I didn't know the cool
lingo.
Mm-hmm. And eventually I figured out how to get it and we started snorting it and we got addicted to it out there. And one night we were completely physically dependent at this point, you know, just snorting it. Like I said, it's powder.
And you were doing the internship, still showing up? And
I was having problems, you know, I was missing work.
Right.
There were rumors that I was doing heroin there and I kept denying it. And one night I was dope sick with her and a couple other guys that we were doing heroin with out there. And I went out to score to this place called King Street in Worcester. And it was snowing. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm definitely not racist at all. And I'm all about equality. But I learned quickly out there that the Puerto Rican guys are the guys to buy heroin off of. Mm-hmm. I always got burned by the black guys out there. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I don't know if that's a gang thing or whatever, but those are the guys that had it. Mm-hmm. This particular night, it was snowing. I only saw a black guy out there. I was really desperate though. And I just went up to him and I asked, I was going to get a bundle. It was like $80, something like that. He said, yeah, I can, you know, I have some, come with me into this abandoned building. So naively, I followed him in there.
My Lord, this is like a horror movie. Come in with me into the abandoned building.
And you know, obviously, okay. Your judgment's so fucking skewed.
And you're desperate. Yeah,
you know,
and
it's like, so I went with him and we get to the stairwell. You know, and the windows had been replaced by plywood with graffiti on it. And as soon as he asked me to take out the money, he pulled out a gun and he started accusing me of being a cop. His eyes were really glassy. I don't know if he was on PCP or if he was smoking crack, whatever the case, he was hopped up on something. And I'm trying to explain to him that, you know, that I'm not a cop. So he wants me to shoot it in front of him. And I was like, I snort it. I'm a college kid. He pulls out this age syringe out of his sock.
Oh, no.
This is in HIV infested Massachusetts, in Worcester, Massachusetts.
Oh, my God.
HIV epidemic raging on at this point. 03, 04 is still very much prevalent there. And I was like, I don't even know how to do that. And before that, I had an entire, you know, a whole lifetime phobia of needles.
Dude.
So I'm explaining to him, I don't know how to do it. And he cooks the shot up in front of me. He's like, put your arm out.
Oh,
I put
my
arm
God.
Out. And so he shot me up with this dirty syringe. It was the first time I ever did it. And
at gunpoint.
And when people go, well, it's not like there was a fucking gun to your head.
You're like, well,
in my situation, there was a gun to my head.
Oh,
I mean,
God,
and look,
dude.
I don't want people listening to think that I think I'm some sort of victim. Like I chose to do drugs
the
whole time.
No, I don't think anyone's thinking that.
I can own up to that. Yeah. But like, fuck, that was.
Yeah,
like
that's gnarly though.
The cocaine thing was cathartic. It was life changing.
Yeah.
The smoking heroin for the first time, but shooting heroin, my life. It was like pressing a self-destruct button.
Did you love it instantly?
I it was.
Instantly. Even with the dirty needle in the situation, you were like, this is the best.
Yeah. It was like having sex for the first time and just being like, oh my God, there's this whole world that I don't even know about.
I hear that from so many people.
Not to, God.
No, see, not I'm to excited, encourage excited. Heroin. But I, no, obviously then I hear that their whole life falls apart. So it's like, oh, 1 second of pleasure is like what? Like a nightmare for the rest of your life. But I do hear that from many people saying it's like opening a new realm.
The way that I describe it in my book is you get a rush of pins and needles. You know, it's when you drink alcohol, you know, that warmth that courses through your body. It's similar to that. And then it feels like, you remember when you were a kid and your parents would wake you up for school and you'd be like, let me sleep for 5 more minutes. And then you'd just be
get in, the best
in that limbo between
that cozy sleep. Yeah.
Sleep and reality. That's what heroin feels like.
Mm-hmm.
And that right there was the feeling. If I could design a feeling that I wanted from a narcotic, that was it.
Mm-hmm.
And within that cozy bliss, no more insecurity, no more thinking about all the bad things that I've done to my family. I'm just at peace. And I didn't realize what an illusion that was then. Shortly thereafter, we got kicked out of that program. We were homeless there for a while.
What was homeless like? Horrible.
We used to have to break into cars because it was snowing.
Did you ever feel bad? Did you ever have remorse, like feel bad for your parents or feel bad for the people that you were robbing?
Not then. You know,
why do you think you didn't?
I think I had a lot of resentment towards them for holding me back, putting me on amphetamines, trying to put blame on anybody but myself, you know?
Right.
And like, as I've healed and gotten older, I realized that that's not true and that I need to own up to my share of it. And that even if you have resentments towards people, you can't use that as an excuse to shoot up heroin. Or, you know, to run around and do stuff like this. But anyway, so I was homeless, moved back to Santa Barbara. I stole $80,000 worth of savings bonds. I bought a kilo of cocaine. I was going to be a coke dealer, abortion, jail, rehabs, moved out to.
What did you go to jail for the first time?
Domestic violence.
Okay. So your first girlfriend, was it the bulimic girl?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And the reason I got that is she was smoking crack pregnant.
Mm-hmm. And you freaked out?
I freaked out. I never hit her. I've never hit a woman. Mm-hmm. I can say that. Never, not once. Mm-hmm. Any woman I've dated would say that. They'll probably say I'm an asshole and I'm emotionally abusive, which I'm not saying is okay either. I've definitely grown since the person I was back then, but
mm-hmm.
never hit her, never hit any girls. I try to stop her from smoking crack. I chased her down the street.
Mm-hmm.
And there were these like surfer guys. This was in Santa Barbara. And they saw me chasing this girl down the street. So they tried to stop me. And one of them put their hand on me. And I said, don't touch me. Put his hand on me again. And I punched him. They called the police.
Mm-hmm.
I continued to chase her. By the time I caught up with her, I had grabbed her. I grabbed her sweatshirt. I was so hurt that she was smoking crack pregnant because I really wanted to have a kid.
Mm-hmm.
I really loved her.
Mm-hmm.
And when I grabbed her, she fell off a curb. And I fell like on top of her. Like we both just tumbled off this curb. And then I just felt a hand grab me and handcuff me.
Did she lose the baby?
We got an abortion.
She chose to have an abortion.
Yeah.
And were you smoking crack while she was pregnant?
Yeah.
So you didn't want her to smoke, but you were still smoking.
Yeah.
So that was probably really hard.
Yeah.
For the whole situation.
And I'll say this, all years later, and we'll get to it, but my wife, when she got pregnant, she was a really bad alcoholic.
Mm-hmm.
And I quit drinking to show just solidarity towards her mm-hmm. because I remembered that.
You have to.
Smoking crack. It's not like her addiction just went away just because she got pregnant. All those years later, I learned from that mistake.
Yeah, and you have to be supportive of one another.
And
you
know? I stopped drinking, you know.
Okay, so you went to jail. Yeah. And how long did you go to jail for that? You said.
I got sentenced to a year.
A year, but you did.
But it was like kind of in an installment plan.
Okay.
Like it was a suspended sentence. Kept sending me away for 30 days, 60 days, 90 days for dirty drug tests. She broke my nose. Month after that.
Okay.
And she got arrested for domestic violence and the charges disappeared the next day. And she went to court saying I never hit her. There was no marks on her or anything, but there was no way for me to beat the case. And then she actually broke my nose. I didn't tell the police that. We're just in a really bad, tumultuous relationship, yeah, as what will happen when you're in a drug relationship like that. We were together about a year. I was in and out of jail, rehabs, and eventually, you know, we broke up. Then I was homeless when I was 19 for a while in Santa Barbara, and then a little bit down here on Skid Row, just running around doing drugs. When she left me, I just went completely off the deep end. Mm-hmm. And eventually I went out to Florida and all sorts of horrible stuff.
How did you get around to all these places when you were homeless?
What do you mean?
Like, how did you get to Florida from here?
When I went to Florida, it was because I was sick of being strung out. And I hadn't talked to my parents in months. And I was like, I need help. And they're like, okay, we'll put you in this rehab, but it was in Florida. So, you know, they were very supportive and they were paying for me to go in and out of rehab for a long, long time.
Never gave up on you.
They never gave up on me. And they definitely instilled unconditional love that I'll always apply towards my own two kids. I have one on the way now too. I have one and I have another one coming. When I was in Florida, so much horrible stuff happened in Florida. It's too much to cover in an hour podcast, but right. I got a possession of heroin, got a felony out there.
After rehab in Florida?
Yeah, served some time out there in jail.
How come all this treatment, all the rehab, all the therapy, all the talk, all this, all that, what made you keep going back to drugs? What do you think made you keep going back?
I think that the more you make mistakes, you know, the more all this horrible stuff happens,
the harder you feel it is to recover.
That baggage starts weighing you down, uh-huh, and it starts haunting you when you're off the drugs. You know, you're on heroin for so long, you don't have to deal with any of that stuff. And then you get sober and all of a sudden it comes back through the floodgate, you know, and you're just like this barrage of like horrible, fucked up stuff that you've done and you have to face that. And like nowadays I can look at myself in the mirror and I'm okay with the person that I'm looking at. But it took me a long, long time to be like that. After I got out of jail in Florida, I came back to Santa Barbara. I left with a felony or with a warrant out here. So I had to go do time here. I was in and out of jail for a long time. Eventually, I became an associate producer for Spike TV. And
how the fuck did that happen? Okay, wait. We're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back with Ryan Leone on Worst Firsts.
Today's episode is brought to you by Angie. Angie has made it easier than ever to connect with skilled professionals to get all your jobs and projects done well. Let me tell you, there's the version of it where you try to do something at home, and then there's a version of it where you have someone help you, you watch them do it the right way, and you go, thank God I didn't try to do that myself. I have fully done things around the home that I think look good, and then a bang in the night, and I wake up to a shelf collapsing, a painting falling off the wall. Like, I've seen it all go south. I own a home, and I can tell you, I know how much work it can take. Whether it's everyday maintenance and repairs or making dream projects a reality, it can be hard just to know where to start. But now all you need to do is Angie that and find a skilled local pro who will deliver the quality and expertise you need. Whatever your home project, big or small, indoor or outdoor, you can Angie that and connect with skilled professionals to get the project done well. Right now, one of my wish lists is I want a bike for my condo in Milwaukee, and I would love to rig it up on a pulley in the ceiling because I have one of those like lofted ceilings, but I'm so scared to try that on my own. Angie has 20 years of home experience and they've combined it with new tools to simplify the whole process. Bring them your project online or with the Angie app. Answer a few questions and Angie can handle the rest from start to finish or help you compare quotes from multiple pros and connect instantly, which means you can take care of any home project in just a few taps. Because when it comes to getting the most out of your home, you can do this when you Angie that. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's ANGI.com.
Hey guys, it's Cheyenne Davis. You may know me from MTV's Teen Mom OG or Think Loud Crew podcast. I'm here with my dad, Papa Floyd, to tell you about our new podcast, Unfiltered Kitchen.
The kitchen is the hub of the household for many of us. The one-stop shop for conversations both big and small. Cheyenne and I have been having open conversations about all aspects of life in our kitchen since well before she was able to see over the counter.
And now we're inviting you into our own kitchen as a part of the family.
Unfiltered Kitchen is a two-way street. I share my advice on cocktails, cooking, parenting, and the lessons I've learned.
And I inform my dad what it's like to raise kids today, how generational barriers affect us, and the joys of being a daughter. Well, your daughter.
Get ready for a whole lot of unfiltered advice. You can take it or leave it, but you're never going to leave this table feeling hungry for more.
Listen to Unfiltered Kitchen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey guys, we're back with Ryan Leone on Worst First. We are talking about his crazy worst, I would say worst first life.
Every day has been the worst first.
He has his novel, Wasting Talent, which if you haven't read it, it's about everything he's talking about right now. So we're just going to keep going. You were talking about now you got this internship at Spike TV. I mean, fuck, I fucking played by the rules and all this shit. I couldn't get a fucking internship at Spike TV. No. So you got a lot of good breaks too.
So with Spike TV, I'll cover this really quickly because I want to get into the prison stuff. But my best friend who passed away last year.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Right here. Died of a drug overdose. I'm actually starting a Narcan initiative to give. You know what Narcan is?
Narcan's to reverse
an overdose.
An overdose, yeah.
And I'm calling it the Paul Project in honor of him. But that was my best friend. And he had gotten, he made like these really crazy underground films. It was kind of like Jackass, but way darker. Like you go around smashing cop car windows with baseball bats and hardcore, crazy stuff. In that film, he lit himself on fire with a wet layer. So you put like a wet piece of clothing and then you light the exterior layer on fire. And that's what they do for films, for, you know, for stunts. They messed up and his entire body got burned very badly. Skin grafts, everything. This is when he was like 16. He had that footage though. We grew up and we became really hardcore drug addicts together. And he had that footage and he's like, Spike wants to buy it for wildest moments caught on tape. Now at that point, I didn't know what I wanted to do, but I knew that I wanted to be in the entertainment industry in some capacity. So I took it as an opportunity to, I was like, he gave me the guy's phone number and address. Told the guy, I said, hey, this footage is too valuable to send. I want to meet up with you in person. So I went and met up with him at Lucky Strikes in Hollywood. And I struck up a conversation. He liked me, and that's how that gig started. And I was making like really good money back then. I was making like $3,000 a week legally, and you know, buying footage like that, like my friend getting put on fire, and then I'd broker it to them. I'd buy a clip for like $200, sell it for like $700 to them.
Right.
Eventually, they just made me an associate producer with them.
Oh, smart.
So,
were you clean?
No.
Okay.
And my crack addiction had really taken off at that point because now I had money and like having that kind of money just threw fuel on an already blazing fire.
So you were doing crack and associate producing.
And heroin. Heroin, crack, and
produce. These guys didn't know? Like, do you think they knew?
They for sure knew. I'd go to meetings down here and they'd be like, hey man, you need to clean up.
Would they say that to you?
I was covered. I looked like the before fucking picture for Proactive. I mean, they knew that I was a junkie, you know? There's no way that I smelled like shit too. Like there's no way that they could not know. And they said it, you know? And so I kept going in and out of rehabs. I've been to like 25 rehabs at this point in my life now. I'm at that point, I don't know, 10, whatever it was. My drug habit got so bad that I started selling drugs to support it. It's the only way I could do it. You know, I'm not exaggerating. I was smoking $600 worth of crack a day at that point.
Jesus, what does crack make you feel like? Like hyper?
Like a weirdo.
Just myself. Just me as I am. I'm like, oh, I feel the same.
Like,
do you
stuck.
Feel like what made you like it? What do you like about crack?
Getting out of my own head.
How does it get you out of your head?
Because it makes you, it turns you into such a weirdo. Like, I mean, I'm already a weirdo, like, but this
makes
a weirdo, you a
bigger like,
weirdo.
Make you think a lot, make you think about weird shit.
It would make me think about weird shit. I get paranoid, I get horny, and sometimes both at the same time, which is like a really fucking weird combination.
Just walking around with a hard on to the cops here.
Yeah, like staring out the window.
Jesus,
like
but who would want to feel that way? Paranoid and horny doesn't sound fun.
That's a testament to how much I hated myself.
You just didn't want to feel sober.
I just didn't want to be in my head anymore.
Sober you had to think about your past and your parents.
And it wasn't even that bad at that point.
Okay, yeah.
My life got so much worse.
Oh, boy.
So I started selling drugs and a lot of drugs, kilos. of MDMA. That was my big thing. I was selling ecstasy.
Where do you get the drugs from?
That's a whole nother story.
Oh, but, my God. Jesus. Like, how does like a drug dealer be like, okay, I'm going to go get some MDMA. Is there like someone that you, how do you find the person who makes the MDMA? Is it just from running in shady circles?
No, this is a good story. So I'm going to tell you,
okay.
But we're going to have to do another episode too, because I can't cover all this.
Well, you don't have to tell me that story. I want to talk about your recovery. I want to talk about the good part. I want to talk about how you got to where you are now, where you're sober. You have a beautiful wife. Your wife, right? You guys are married, or is it your girlfriend? You're not married, but you have a wonderful significant other.
We have a two and a half year old
child. You have a baby on the way. You have a house. You drive a nice car. You're doing well, and you are not on drugs anymore. And you've overcome all this. You've made friends with celebrities who I'm not going to name. That you have. You're going to be writing their books, you know, like you have so many beautiful things on the horizon. How did you get to that point? How did you finally say enough is enough?
It's so hard to answer a question like that because it's so convoluted to where I was, where I'm talking about right before this point to then. That's,
yeah.
You know, that's why. So do you want me to like give you the cliff notes of what got me to like,
yeah, that? How many more times do you go to jail and do drugs and get hooked to heroin and get hooked to crack? And like, what was the breaking point that you said?
Okay. So I started selling drugs. That's a good story, but I will save that for another time.
Yeah.
Eventually I got busted by the FBI and DEA.
Okay.
You know, and I got arrested. They let me go.
Okay.
I had no idea why.
How much money were you making?
$10,000 a week.
Okay.
You know, that was on average. Sometimes I make 70 grand in one deal though. So, I mean, just, I had so much money at that time. I was never in it for the money either. It was just to support my habit. Mm-hmm. But at that level, money just started flowing in like that. Eventually I got busted and I was facing 10 to life. Mm-hmm. That's what they told me. You're going to do 10 years. In my head, I was so delusional at that point that I thought I had so much money that I'd be able to pay my way out of it. I thought that's how it worked.
You thought you could just pay the cops to not put you in jail?
I had like $250,000 cash that I was like, okay, I can give them that. That's not even a lot of money. But like at that time, I thought it was, you know, I was 23 years old at the time. Then they told my attorney, we're going to indict his girlfriend. I had a girlfriend at the time. She was 5 years older than me. We've been together like for a few years. And we made a deal where I'd go turn myself in.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, all right, I'll go turn myself in to the feds, but you can't indict her federally. Mm-hmm. So they made a deal with my attorney that said that. I turned myself in. I didn't come out for 4.5 years. I thought I was going to get out like within a couple of days. I thought I'd get bail.
That's you went in at 24?
At 23.
23 years old, federal prison.
Mm-hmm.
And you were in there for 4 years.
Yeah.
With all those crazy dudes.
Mm-hmm.
Did you get raped?
No.
Did they try to rape you?
No.
No one tried to rape you?
No.
And you were like handsome.
I've never been offered to prostitute myself for drugs and I never got raped in prison. I'm not saying I wanted to.
Right.
These are just weird myths that don't
always happen.
Because I thought for sure, like when
aren't there guys banging each other in prison?
Not overtly. I never knew anybody that was having sex in there. That's a whole other thing. There's politics in there that would prohibit you from doing that. You're not allowed to do that. You get murdered if you get caught engaging in homosexual activity. I'm sure it happened.
You were so young.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Were you one of the youngest?
Yeah.
And did people protect you or did they?
Yeah. Yeah. I think a lot of people looked at me as like a younger brother. Kind of like a clownish kind of guy, not to be taken. You know, I was scared to go to prison. I wasn't like a tough guy or anything. I was a drug addict and I definitely didn't belong there. In federal prison, you're dealing with like very serious people.
Yeah, people murdered people.
It's the worst of the worst. Yeah. You don't have a beef with the state. You have a beef with the whole United States government. So anyway, so I go to prison and my girlfriend that I turned myself in for, she died while I was in there. And
how did she die?
She died of an overdose. And this is the worst part about that. After I turned myself in, so they wouldn't arrest her. The state arrested her. So the feds were like, well, we didn't arrest her, but they handed it to the state. So they basically tricked us into me turning myself in. And then she died a fugitive. She was scared, alone in Las Vegas. And she got found with a needle in her arm. They tricked us. You know, I turned myself in under the pretense that they would let her go. So this is how I got sober. I got sober for 3 years in that term. And yeah, prison was horrible.
What was the worst part about prison?
I mean, aside from the almost near daily violence, you know, people getting stabbed, seen people, I told this story on a different podcast. I saw somebody they got baby oil and they put it in a coffee cup and put it in the microwave and boiled it and threw it on somebody's face and their eyeball came out like a dangling earring. And I watched it and I can still hear that scream like reverberating down some like endless corridor. That PTSD haunts me. That was one of the worst things I saw. I saw people get stabbed. I'd say the worst part, honestly, was just the barbaric disregard that the guards had. They treated us like we weren't human beings. They don't give you a pillow, for instance. Basic, you know,
human needs.
Basic conduits for comfort mm-hmm. that they won't give you because they make you feel like you're less than human. Mm-hmm. That was the worst part. I did drugs the whole time I was in prison, except
for
the last year.
How do you get drugs in prison?
People bring them in the visiting room. They exchange a balloon, like, you know, say Tommy's in prison. You go visit him.
He told me that they drank and smoked and everything in his prison too. And he was in isolation. They still got it to him.
Yeah, I read that in his book. Yeah. They'd slide him
under the door. Yeah, Pruno. Uh-huh.
You know, people bring balloons full of drugs. You get two kisses in a contact visit and they just slide the balloon in and then you
swallow it and then throw it up later.
Throw it up later. And then guards bring it in quite a bit as well.
Guards?
Yeah. Oh. Nowadays, they're having drones drop off packages.
I heard about that.
So I was doing drugs the whole time, always in debt, petrified that I was going to get murdered in there over debts. And I almost did.
Because you owed people.
I owed $5,000 at one point. And my freaked out parents were helping me. And then at a certain point, they're just like, you know.
So you were like, I need money because I got to pay, you know, this guy over here that I owe money to. And your parents were like, oh, okay, because we don't want you to get
murdered. Up to a certain point.
How much did they pay?
Oh, my.
Like thousands?
Tens of thousands.
Oh, my God. Your poor parents.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you sit here now and
absolutely
feel so bad for
absolutely
your parents?
And I make an effort every single day
to tell them thank you and I love you and thank you for sticking by me. Yeah.
Every day.
Yeah.
And what ended up happening ultimately at the end of that term, I was in there 4.5 years. Mm-hmm. The last year that I was in there, somebody gave me heroin. Someone I didn't know. And they're like, hey, I heard you do heroin. I was like, I do, you know? And so they gave me some. An hour later, I got drug tested. The guy set me up. You know, he was a snitch. And they put me in solitary confinement for 60 days. No book, no radio, nothing. Just me inside my own fucking
mind.
That
was him for 6 months.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I did 60 days. That's the longest. Yeah. No. Well, this last term, I did 4 months in there. But it
he told me it was absolutely insane.
When I was in state, I had a celly. You know, I had a roommate or whatever, but in the feds, I was by myself. And what happened is my grandfather died while I was in there and they came and told me. And usually in a situation like that, I would self-medicate, but I just went back to my cell and I had to sit there in my own shit and think about the fact that he died knowing I was a junkie. And there's nothing I could do about that. It made me completely rethink my life.
Wow.
And I stayed sober for 3 years after that point.
Good.
Yeah.
And then you stayed sober for 3 years and then you got back on.
My book got published.
So you wrote the book.
In prison.
Mm-hmm. How'd you get a publishing deal?
I self-published it.
Good for you.
Mm-hmm. I sold 177,000 copies.
Good for you. Where can we get this book right now?
On Amazon.
Wasting Talent on Amazon, Ryan Leone. And it says 100% of your proceeds from this book will go to prison reform,
I donate
great.
Every cent from that book, and I got a film deal from it. But yeah, we'll get into that. I'm going to try to just get through this real quick. So I got out, I got sober for 3 years. I was happy. Mm-hmm. You know, I learned in there what really helped me get sober was fitness. Mm-hmm. You know, I worked out and the same dopamine and endorphin release, you know, it was tantamount to drugs.
Right.
And now I could do it without, you know, having to spend $200 a day, you know, and it's a healthy addiction. I started feeling good. I started looking good. Like, my confidence, for once, I wasn't insecure anymore. I was confident. I got out. My life was great. Got the book published. It did okay in the beginning.
Yeah.
It got progressively better as the years went on, but I got engaged to this girl. Everything was going good. We had a condo down in Encino. I had a BMW. Everything was cool. And then my friend had LSD and he's like, hey, we can trip sober. He was sober too. And again, that old way of thinking, I'm an artist. Mm. I can do acid and have introspection. And the truth is you get way, way more valid and real introspection without any drugs. Mm. You don't need psychedelics to do that. Although I've had some good profound experiences with insights, but I did the LSD. The next day, I just didn't feel sober anymore. And a week later, I had a needle in my arm again.
Jesus.
That was in
2015. Wow.
And so then, all right, I'm going to do the cliff notes here. So then, in and out of rehabs again. I'm still on federal parole.
Oh my God.
I tell them that I relapsed, which I shouldn't have done. Mm. Like, hey, I relapsed. I want help. I had the best intentions with it. But then they were on me, you know, and they wouldn't let me come off parole. Mm. I ended up getting a fan letter from a woman in Colorado. Mm. She's like, hey, like, your biggest fan. I saw a picture of her and I was like, oh, I'll fly you out to California. We got married a week later.
Oh my gosh.
We'd been up for like a few days on cocaine at the time. Worst year of my life was being married to her. Like, just I always been in toxic relationships. That one was
the most.
Yeah. And eventually I got in a car accident. I had a little bit to drink before that. I got a DUI, but I blew a 0.06, which isn't a DUI. The legal limit in California is 0.08. My PO said, nope, we're sending you back to prison anyway for a violation. Even like, I beat the case. I went to court in the state. I beat it. I had to go back to prison for 90 days. Mm-hmm. I lost everything. My wife left, lost my car. Get out. Now I really want to change. This is in 2017. Mm-hmm. There was interest with getting a film deal for that movie or for the book. I went to AA voluntarily. I met a girl. She was a prostitute. She told me that she'd been getting raped and beat up, going to meeting guys off back pages. She couldn't get conventional employment because she had felonies. Mm-hmm. She was in her 20s. She said, will you go with me to this hotel and make sure that I'm okay? I'm just sick of getting abused. And I literally told her, there's text messages. I said, you don't need to do this. You're better than this. Mm-hmm. I don't judge anybody. Consensual adults, I think, should be able to do what they want. Mm-hmm. I realize it's illegal, but I go with her to the hotel to make sure she's okay. It's an undercover sting operation.
Oh boy!
I've been out of prison for 2 weeks for the violation. I bail out, and I didn't realize that pimping and pandering, which is what they had charged me with, which is, I didn't even do that. It should have been protecting a prostitute, which is basically making sure that a sex worker is you know, not in harm's way or whatever. It carries a mandatory minimum of 3 years in state prison. Plus, the feds were trying to give me a huge violation on top of that. Then I meet girl that I'm with now. Beautiful, wonderful woman I'm in love with. I get her pregnant like within 2 weeks. I'm out on bail knowing I'm going back to prison for years. Mm-hmm. I get her pregnant. And she's like, I want to keep it. And we're both hardcore alcoholics at the time. By that point in my life, I'm drinking like 2 fifths of whiskey a day. And I never had a problem with alcohol, but it had just kind of like evolved into that. Mm-hmm. Then I get a film deal for that book right around that time. My drinking is out of control. My parents kick me out. I'm homeless again. I get the film deal. And I end up meeting some people that want to make a documentary about my life. One of my closest friends is this guy, Jim Ohls, who wrote the screenplay for the David Fincher film Fight Club. Mm-hmm. Brad Pitt, Edward Norton, it's one of my favorite movies.
Yeah, same.
He's one of my closest friends. He's a mentor to me. He's the screenwriter of that. He's like, yeah, I'll be the writer for that documentary. We have all this archive. Everything I've told you, we have like on film for some weird reason. I have my whole life on film. Mm-hmm. So we start doing this documentary about my life. And I know I'm going back to prison. I know that I'm going to miss the birth of my first kid. I start getting press. Huffington mm-hmm. Post is covering me. Penthouse, a local newspaper. Celebrities are throwing me an event. You know, I'm meeting all these famous people that were just heroes to me. And now I'm with them. And I went crazy. I literally lost my mind. I had a full-blown emotional breakdown. Mm-hmm. Staying up for 8-9 days, not on drugs. Thinking that people were trying to kill me. I thought that my parole officer was trying to kill me because I was pushing prison reform.
Did you get a little bit paranoid schizophrenic?
Yeah. I mean, this is all
in
the
document. I have it in my family. That's the only reason why, because it sounds like
it's I'll show you clips of it after mm-hmm. this. It's really scary. Like, you know, I lost like 15, 20
And you weren't on drugs at this point? Mm-mm. It was just the surrealness of your life, what your life had become.
Yeah,
it was kind of triggering.
It was too much. Mm-hmm. And eventually, they just put me back in jail. They revoked my bail. You know, the feds violated me. It was horrible.
How did they just put you back in? Did something happen?
They made up shit that wasn't even true. Like, it's very convoluted, but basically, I told them I was going to start smoking marijuana medicinally and that I had a recommendation from a doctor. They said, cool, it's fine. So I started smoking weed legally with my medical marijuana. And like 2 weeks later, they're like, oh, actually, you can't do that on federal parole. But I'm like, but you told me that I could. Doesn't matter. If you've done it already, we're going to violate you. So I got violated for that. So they just kind of like sensationalized stuff, made it up.
Okay. So how do we get to Ryan now, who has a baby, has a wife?
I was very conscientious of the remaining 7 minutes. So I systematically like I went through my whole life like very quickly.
I know it sucks because I can only post an hour on Instagram. I can't until they make it longer. I know there's so much more.
I just never shut the fuck up.
No, it's great. We love it. I don't shut the fuck up either.
But and you're hilarious. I watched bunch of your videos before I came here. Okay. So worst prison term of my life. Mm-hmm. You know, I was in a bunch of different riots. I got 3 ribs broken the first week I was in there. I got beat up, got 8 stitches. I got sentenced to 3 years in the state, 8 months in the feds. I did 16 months altogether. They kind of like bundled it all together, run it concurrent. You know, at that point, I'm like, documentary, that was not going to happen anymore. The film, I just fucked up everything by going crazy. Do you know who I am? You know, shit like that. I had like 300 Twitter followers. I was like, do you realize who the fuck you're talking to? Stuff like that, right?
You're like, account 005 with no face follows me. Dead. Oh my God, I can't.
So, but I got healthy in there, you know? And my girlfriend at the time and I, it wasn't even a real relationship. It was like a drunken fling, but she stood by me the whole time. Mm-hmm. We worked on our relationship and I really fell in love with her while I was in prison. Like, she was just amazing to me and I did not deserve that. I was a piece of shit to her. But she just extended that kind of unconditional love that I'd learned from my family. And so we got really close while I was in there. Mm-hmm. Horrible, traumatic term. Like I said, multiple riots. Worst term I did. That 16 months was infinitely worse than mm-hmm. that other term that I, the 4.5 year one. Mm-hmm. So I get out and I'm just.
What year was it?
I got out in 2019. Mm-hmm. I get out.
This is literally like a year ago.
Yeah. I get out and I can't get any employment. I'm going and I'm trying so hard to provide for my family. I can't, like, nobody will hire me. Fast food restaurants. I'm not saying that that's not a worthy profession, but they wouldn't hire me. I was getting really despondent. You know, I was like, fuck, you know, I didn't know what to do. And
don't the prisons have placement for you after you serve time? Don't they try to place you?
No.
No, they don't.
No, okay. That's a whole nother. Okay, we got 5 minutes. I'm going to go harder.
Okay, go ahead.
All right. So So I finally get a job in like Reseda, like working for a telemarketing place. I'm making like $15 an hour. Mm-hmm. There's like these weird like emo managers with like gauge earrings, like talking down to me. And one day I was like, you know what? Fuck you, man. I couldn't, it was just too demoralizing. And I left. And the next day, two things happened. I got invited up to Johnny Depp's house. He's a fan of my book. That didn't change my life, but it did in a lot of ways because it gave me this confidence. It's like somebody that I'd always
admired,
really looked up to, and he was giving me validation. Coincidentally, the same day, I was on a podcast. This guy, American Dope, Al Profit, got like 400,000 views. So I started my own YouTube channel. It's my name, Ryan Leone. I have not worked a day since then.
Good
right?
for you.
My film deal came back.
God bless.
We got the documentary back into production. I've signed 5 contracts this year. I've sold 2 screenplays.
Oh my God.
And in the midst of all that, YouTube completely changed my life, and then Patreon, right? And I came out with a comedy album we were talking about. That's why I brought him up with Johnny.
He came up Johnny's with you on and Johnny there. Depp did a comedy album.
Well,
together.
he's a guest star on it, and so is Tommy Chong, Boston George from Blow, Freeway Ricky Ross, Simon Dirt Nasty. Let me say their real name.
Simon Rex.
Dirt Nasty. Simon. That persona. Nick Stahl.
Yeah.
And but anyway, yeah. So that came out. In the midst of all of that, my best friend died of an overdose. And it just completely changed the way that I look at my life, you know? I was out, I was being a father. I love my son. Every time I look at him, it gives me so much purpose in my life. It's the most profound love I've ever experienced. And it really makes me think about how I made my own parents feel. And it's helped me so much. And she just got pregnant again. So we got another one on the way.
And is she sober now too?
Yeah.
Good. Because you need that kind of support.
Yep. And like, I haven't been, I've fucked up over the last year. I've slipped. You know, I'm a legitimate drug addict. But, you know, and I know cliche, but I really do take it one day at a time. And now I'm able to support a family of 3 just off my creative stuff, off Patreon, YouTube. Book royalties, which I donate all those. Anytime you buy a paperback, I use the money to send free books to inmates.
That's nice.
But the most important thing, besides being a father, besides being a good husband, and besides being a good son and friend, is when my friend Paul Harper died. His girlfriend, his fiance found him.
Oh, boy.
If they had Narcan in the house, he'd still be alive. No, she found him like 10 minutes too late.
I feel like everyone should have it in the house.
And the way that I look at, wrapping it up clean, everybody should have it in the house. And in states, a lot of places they give it away for free. There's states where they charge $150 for 2 doses of it. What heroin addict is going to spend $150 on 2 doses of Narcan? You know, people have a hard time spending $3 for a pack of condoms. You know, they're not going to spend $150 for that. So my goal now is to, I've filed with the Secretary of State, got the Paul Narcan Project. That's the most important thing in my life, like way above my career, because I feel that one way that you have to stay, you know, one thing that keeps everybody sober, it's an indispensable part of recovery is altruism. You have to pay your karmic debt, and you have to do selfless acts to make the world a better place. And in turn, it makes you feel okay with yourself.
Yeah, give back.
That's how I can stay off drugs.
Yeah.
I know that every day I make an effort to make the world a better place, not a worse place. And I spent so many years being parasitical.
Yeah.
You know, being a leech on society. You're probably responsible for people dying, selling drugs. Like, in no way have I ever, you know, glorified that, or I hope that people don't interpret it that way. These are all things that I have to deal with now. That's how I deal with them, is I try as hard as I can to do what I need to do to make the world better around me. So that's something that's coming in the near future, the Paul Narcan Project.
That's awesome.
I've been working really hard.
Good.
that that artist that I gave you the painting, Sinister Monopoly. He's really helped me raise a lot of money for it.
That's amazing. You know,
that's how I got it going. He donated a lot of art for me, and he believes in it. We've seen a lot of friends die that way, and
everyone should be able to have it. You know,
it needs
to,
be as ubiquitous as
Tylenol or
fire extinguisher that's at a house, you know, that needs to be in every public bathroom.
Right.
How many times do people find somebody overdosed? They call 911. You go into a shallow state of respiratory arrest. There is an interval where you can be saved. Mm-hmm. If that was everywhere, we'd save a lot of lives. So every time that I'm going to be sending a free box of doses of Narcan, I know that that's a tangible
a life you've saved
response. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a karmic response that makes me feel better. Yeah. And that's going to save a lot of people. Yeah. And that's that.
I think you're on the right track now.
It was
I'm proud of you for, you know, because I know the guilt and the shame and all of that stuff is super triggering. I know it is. I mean, we've all done things in our lives that we're not proud of, and I know it's really hard being sober and having to live with thinking about it. But I think what you're doing now, you know, is the way to healing, building back the karmic good, doing as much good as you possibly can right now. That's all you can do. Build it back. And it's easy. You just got to keep doing good things, whether it's the smallest thing, opening a door for a stranger, or a huge thing like doing the Narcan project, being good to people, being empathetic, being there for people. You're on the right. You're doing it. You know?
Yeah. No, yeah. I agree with every word you said.
Yeah.
1,000,000%.
Yeah. Just got to be the best person that you can be now. I mean, God, you're only 35 years old, Rye. I mean, I'd like to think we're still pretty young.
I look like fucking 30 years older than you.
I'd like to think we're still pretty young, dude. Like, we got a lot of time to be the best. Fuck, to be the best.
That's right.
Right?
Yeah.
And that goes with anyone listening to this right now who is in a dark place, who's struggling with addiction, who feels like there's no coming back because of all the things that they've done or done to other people and the guilt that they're living with. There is, if you open your eyes tomorrow, that's another chance. That's another chance to turn it all around. Okay? Like, you open your eyes, that's your chance to go, you know what? The fucking stops here. This is where it stops, and this is where I flip the fucking script and I live the best possible life that I can, and nothing is going to stop me from doing that.
Absolutely.
Not letting drugs, not letting anything else, my negative thinking, whatever.
It's about building bridges after burning them, you know, and you know, that's...
And it's not easy, you know, like, you need support. You need support systems. You need people to call. You need, you know, books to read. You need inspiration. But it's always there. It's always around you, you know, especially, and I know people aren't like big AA fans or whatever, but if you find the right person in that community, because there are really great people. My husband has a fucking awesome sponsor, and this is years of, you know, being back and forth with the same stuff. When you find someone who really understands you and goes, you know what, like, we're going to get through this together, not giving up on you, then... You do that, and that's what you know, everybody needs a shoulder to lean on sometimes, you know?
Yeah.
So I'm proud of you.
Thank you.
You got this, dude. Like, you know, all the crazy shit you've been through, you're 35 and the fucking buck stops here, and now it's all about positive lifestyle and all the beautiful fucking wonderful things you're gonna do, where you can look back and go, man, I was... struggled and I did some fucked up shit and I hurt people and I hurt myself, but now I fucking have turned it around and I'm a fucking charitable man. I'm creating amazing projects. I'm writing amazing things. I'm working with incredible people. Like, I have a huge bright future ahead of me. Yeah. And a long future.
I feel really optimistic right now, and people ask me, they're like, are you happy? And I can honestly say I am.
Good.
I'm happy.
Good.
You know, it's not, I don't need to smoke crack to get out of my head anymore, because I like being in my head. Yeah. I like myself, you know?
And you should like yourself. Fuck, you should love yourself.
I do love myself.
Even all the little fucking broken pieces, like, we are, that's what gives us all character. All these little weird thoughts that we have, all these little idiosyncrasies and the things we struggle with. Like, I've hated myself and worked against myself for years with my anxiety disorder. And now I'm like, yeah, it fucking sucks. And I would do anything to never have anxiety again. But I'm also at a point in my life where, like, I am just like, you know what? I am going to learn to embrace my life. You know, I'm not going to keep fighting. I'm going to go, you know what? This is me. This is who I am. This is who I'm supposed to be. And I'm going to fucking embrace it. And I'm going to live my life this way. You know, I feel like every time we try to fight it, it just ends up worse. You know,
it does. Yeah. It's, yeah. It's, that's, you know, it's, I also, you know, I make the vast, you know, the majority of my income from YouTube.
Yeah.
And Patreon, just telling stories about my life.
Is it Ryan Leone on YouTube?
Yeah. Okay.
I'll put that all here.
People always ask me, they're like, why? Because I'm very self-deprecating on there.
Yeah, a lot of people are who've, you know, been through it.
And like, but like extreme, just honest about, more honest than I was. I'm not saying I was dishonest, but I go in more explicitly. People always ask me why I do that. And because I find intrinsic value in sharing
being
those
real
life experiences with people. Maybe it can dissuade somebody else from going down that same path. Other people that are really fucked up write me all the time and they're like, hey, hearing how fucked up you are makes me feel okay with the mistakes I've made, because I embrace them. You know, I'm not trying to run away from them. I'm trying to weaponize them positively, you know, use them in a positive sense and help people. And that's what it's all about.
As long as, you know, it's a learning experience, I feel like, you know, obviously we're human and we can do a lot of horrible, horrible things. And I'm not saying there's an excuse for every horrible thing that everyone's ever done, but I'm saying that if people genuinely can learn from their mistakes and have genuine empathy and heal and find a new path, like that's the best thing that can happen from it. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So Val, that was so inspiring. It was so inspiring to have you on. We made it.
Brittany, I really do appreciate it.
I'm so grateful to have you here. And guys, make sure to pick up Ryan's book, Wasting Talent. And make sure to follow him on YouTube and on Instagram and to hear more of his stories. Obviously, we only have an hour here and he's got a plethora of stories I'm sure you guys would resonate with or not resonate with and just want to hear. You know, make sure to check him out. And I'm so proud of you.
Thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Keep doing the good stuff. Okay?
Thank you, Brittany.
Yay. And we'll see you all next week on another episode of Worst First.
Today's episode is brought to you by Angie. Angie has made it easier than ever to connect with skilled professionals to get all your jobs and projects done well. Let me tell you, there's the version of it where you try to do something at home, and then there's a version of it where you have someone help you, you watch them do it the right way, and you go, thank God I didn't try to do that myself. I have fully done things around the home that I think look good, and then a bang in the night, and I wake up to a shelf collapsing, a painting falling off the wall. Like, I've seen it all go south. I own a home, and I can tell you, I know how much work it can take. Whether it's everyday maintenance and repairs or making dream projects a reality, it can be hard just to know where to start. But now all you need to do is Angie that and find a skilled local pro who will deliver the quality and expertise you need. Whatever your home project, big or small, indoor or outdoor, you can Angie that and connect with skilled professionals to get the project done well. Right now, one of my wish lists is I want a bike for my condo in Milwaukee, and I would love to rig it up on a pulley in the ceiling because I have one of those like lofted ceilings, but I'm so scared to try that on my own. Angie has 20 years of home experience and they've combined it with new tools to simplify the whole process. Bring them your project online or with the Angie app. Answer a few questions and Angie can handle the rest from start to finish or help you compare quotes from multiple pros and connect instantly, which means you can take care of any home project in just a few taps. Because when it comes to getting the most out of your home, you can do this when you Angie that. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's ANGI.com.